Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, this week, Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois, are once again hosting Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. This is the 9th annual version of the festival. Got underway with the first film last night, and there will be films shown today, tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, out at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. Also, there are a lot of people here in Champaign-Urbana to come for the festival to watch the movies, and these are people who love movies and people who are involved in making them. There will be some panel discussion, so there are a lot of events going on in connection with the festival. So we thought, well, this would be a good time for us to spend some time talking about movies with some people who are here for the festival, and we're pleased to welcome to the program here, actually welcome back, I think I should say, to the program, C.O. Doc Erickson, a man who has had a very long career as producer and production manager on some of Hollywood's biggest films, which was pretty good considering that when he went out to Hollywood in the 40s, that really wasn't his plan. And he says, in fact, one of the reasons he went was he just thought it might be nice to see the Pacific Ocean. Well, it turned into a very long and productive career. He started out working at Paramount. He served as production manager for 5 films directed by Alfred Hitchcock, among them Rear Window and The Man Who Knew Too Much and Go. Then after that, he was associate producer John Huston on the film The Misfits and some others. He's also worked with Robert Evans on Chinatown and a number of other movies, including Urban Cowboy and Popeye and 55 Days at Peking and Blade Runner and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and a bunch of others. And we're pleased that he could be with us and spend some time talking about his experiences in the movie business and maybe how things have changed and how they continue to change. Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, give us a call. Well, thanks for being here.
Thank you, David. Very nice to be here again.
You grew up in Kankakee?
Yes. Well, near Kankakee.
Near Kankakee. Near
Manteno was my school, high school, and I grew up on a farm near Manteno.
So when you – I know you came to the University of Illinois to study agriculture, so you actually had some experience in agriculture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think it was also part of the reason that you came to the U of I was that somehow someone managed to wangle you a scholarship.
So that that's really the way I got here was a scholarship, actually. It was because of that I had an ag teacher in high school who was a wonderful fellow and insisted that I have to have a college education, and that the way to get it, since I couldn't afford to go to college, was to get a scholarship. And he said, well, the way I can guarantee you a scholarship is take the exam and indicate that you want an agriculture scholarship, because in one or two or three of the counties somewhere, somebody will fail to take the exam or pass on the possibility, and we can get one for you for sure. So that's what we did, and it worked out fine.
Yeah. So tell me the story about how it is that you ended up going to California, though, for the first time.
Well, after school, after I left here in March of 43, because I was drafted and wasn't in the Army very long, and they found I had a heart murmur and classified me 4F, and I went home. I went to DeKalb, Illinois, to be near a girl that I knew at the time, and got a job with Interstate Aircraft. They were making a drone aircraft for the Navy. We only manufactured, I think, 2, maybe 3. Maybe the third one was still on the line when it was canceled a year later. The contract was canceled a year later. And the fellow I was working for, Bill Bundy, was from Santa Monica, California, and he said, why don't you come on out to California and he said, see the ocean and so forth, and it's how wonderful it is, body surfing, et cetera, sunbathing. I said, oh, that sounds good. I'll go. And away we went.
And how did you end up getting your first job working in the movie business?
Well, Bill Bundy, went to work at Paramount through connections that his father had with some people at Paramount, and Bill got hired. And he was only there a couple of months when he saw a notice on a bulletin board that there was an opening in the budget department. So he told me about it and said, come on in, get an interview and see what happens. And I did, and they hired me, and that started my career in the film business.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first job that you had? What did you
budget, in the budget department, estimating cost of films that they were making. But we didn't really estimate the cost. We compiled the estimates that were given us by the various departments. Mm-hmm. That was our job. But it was interesting because I learned immediately that it took so many people and so many departments to actually pull a motion picture together, yeah, physically. You know? Yeah.
So that was something that you probably, having watched movies, and I think that's probably the thing that most people, unless maybe you sit there at the end of the movie and you watch all the names of the people go by.
That's
that,
true.
That makes
yeah.
some impression on you. You think, boy, it takes a lot of people to make movies, but I'm not exactly sure if you really relate to that the way that you do when you're actually in the business, if you were responsible for, say, the payroll of all those people.
Well, that's a different matter. But no, it was a tremendous education for me to start where I did, because I could have found a slot in the accounting department or in some other department, and you get the impression that, oh, my department is the most important one in this whole situation. Whereas in the budget department, compiling all of these figures, I realized that we weren't the most important, of course, mm-hmm. and neither was any of the other departments, except they were all important. Yeah. So,
you know, I think that probably a lot of people, maybe they have a kind of idea what the director does, but I expect that probably people don't really understand what the producer of a movie does. What basically is the job of the producer?
Well, it depends on what kind of producer you're talking about. There are producers who are able to find a story that they like and they buy the rights to it and then take it to a studio or someone to finance it and be the driving force behind getting a project underway. And then they'll maintain a hold of it, of course, and be a participant in the casting of the picture along with the studio. And maybe they will select a director, perhaps somebody they had in mind all in the first place. And then the director and the producer together will sort of supervise the making of their movie. And mm-hmm. But the director is really the fellow who makes it eventually. It becomes his view, his vision, and hopefully that it's the same vision that the producer had in mind. Yeah. Otherwise, there's problems. You know?
Well, I suppose one of the problems maybe sometimes with movies is that there are people who have competing visions and who have different people who are actually in a position to influence what the movie turns out to be. So it's not just the director. The director might have an idea about what he or she wants, but there are all kinds of other people who have ideas too and who are in a position to get their ideas wedged in.
Well, there are pressures, of course, and those come from the producer, perhaps, who in the initial making of the deal had something in mind and hates to let go of it. The studio generally has an idea of what kind of picture that they want, and they will put pressure on the director, it's true. And the director oftentimes, though, will fight back and eventually get his way. Mm-hmm. He's the fellow you have to depend on to get the results that you want. You want a picture that you can release. And so you can't just take the attitude of, well, I don't like what he's doing and I want him to change or else. Mm-hmm. Then that sets up a battle.
I suppose, I suppose for everybody wants the picture to be successful and they want it to make money. To some people, I suppose making money may be more important. And I guess I think about times when producers and the studio have this idea that they want it to be one kind of movie or they think a certain kind of movie is what will be successful. The director has another idea. For example, one of the movies I think of is Blade Runner, a movie that you were involved with. The director had one idea about what he wanted the movie to be, particularly about how he wanted the movie to end. And the studio, they didn't like that, and they changed it. And now, actually, you can see, because some years ago, there was a director's cut released.
Right, right.
So if you really want to see the version that the director had in mind, mm-hmm. you can see the movie that he wanted. You can see the movie that the studio wanted.
Right.
You can watch both of them and make up your mind which one you like better. But there's always going to be, you know, unless I suppose the director has the right of the final cut to say, this is it, nobody messes with it, then it's always possible that somebody at the studio could look at the movie and say, you know, I got some problems with this, and actually change it and make it into a different movie.
There's no question about that. That happens. But there are only a handful of directors who ever are given that final cut. You know, mm-hmm. And the studio just will not do it because it's their money.
What did just to take that one for an example, did you have a particular feeling about Blade Runner and about this dispute between the studio and their version and the director and his version?
Well, the thing about the Blade Runner was that it was obvious that Ridley Scott is a very strong director and mm-hmm. had very strong ideas about how he wanted this picture to go together. And he's brilliant. He really is a very creative fellow. And the other thing that was good about or really interesting about Ridley was that he would have these face-to-face meetings with the producers, with Jerry Parencio and Phil and Jordan, and he would. They would go at it tooth and nail for 30 or 40 minutes, and by the end, he convinced them that he was right, and it was in their interest to put up another $1 million, and they would get it back tenfold, you know. But so the picture went on and on and on, and it's a tremendously interesting movie.
Yeah, well, I think so too, and it continues to be a movie that I would, if someone came along and said you want to sit down and watch that, I'd say sure, of course, because at the time it had a tremendous visual impact. It was one of those movies that every once in a while, if you're lucky, you come along, and you see a movie, and you sort of say, "Well, I've just never seen anything like that, quite like that before."
Yes,
and I think it holds up pretty well.
Well, the effects in it are fantastic too. When you consider this was still quite a while ago, mm-hmm. it didn't have the advantage of the computer generated effects like we have today.
Mm-hmm. We had a caller. If there are other folks, by the way, who'd like to be involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that by picking up the telephone and giving us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free. 333-9455. That's the local number. Our guest is Doc Erickson, CEO Doc Erickson. He's been an executive producer in Hollywood, over 30 years' experience as producer and production manager. He worked on a number of films of Alfred Hitchcock's, Rear Window, To Catch a Thief, The Trouble with Harry, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and Vertigo. Also, in some of his other movies, he was involved in The Misfits, directed by John Huston, Joseph Mankiewicz's film There Was a Crooked Man. We worked with Robert Evans on Chinatown, on Urban Cowboy, on Blade Runner, Nicholas and Alexandra, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, The Lonely Guy, Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day.
That was one of your movies, too?
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right? Just as recently, the last film was Antitrust. That was 2001. Are you...
One followed that, Wind Talkers.
Oh, okay.
Nicholas Cage.
Oh, right.
About the
Navajo Code Talkers in World War II.
Yeah, 2000.
He is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana for the Ebert Fest, the 9th annual Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival, and we're pleased to have him here on the show. We do have a caller here. This is Farina, I think, actually, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Boy, what a list of films you've mentioned. What an honor to talk to somebody that's been involved with such great movie making. The film The Misfits is just fascinating to me. I truly think it's one of the great films ever made. The people that worked on that, the producers, everyone must have known there was, you know, just from the cast. Could you talk about that film? And I don't know what to say about the film. And what was it like to work with the people that were involved. Thanks.
Well, sure. Thank you. It was a great film. It's one of my favorites, obviously. It was really a pleasure to work with all of these people. We did have problems with Marilyn toward the end of the filming. But up until that time, it was really great. I mean, Clark Gable, Monty Clift, who could have been troublesome, was not. He was wonderful. And everybody was a solid performer. Eli Wallach, Thelma Ritter, and so on. Marilyn was the one, person who was just a question mark, and we did have our problems toward the end of the film. And poor thing, she was just really going downhill physically, mentally, or whatever, and it just took its toll on her, and that became a headache for us.
As a producer, do you spend much time actually on the set?
Well, quite a bit, yes, because in my case, I usually try to be on the set at the start of filming in the morning and stay until they have gotten the first shot or so. And then there's work to be done at the office, so you go back, and then I would maybe show up at around lunchtime again and discuss things with everybody because you get that break where you can sit down and talk. And then drift away, come back again late in the day, be there when the picture, when the set wraps up for the evening.
We were talking just before we got going a little bit or mentioned the fact that you had worked on Chinatown, which I think around here we all think was a pretty good movie.
I do too.
And it seems to be a case where you got everything coming together. You had great actors. You have a great director. You had a good story. It was the art direction was wonderful. It was wonderfully photographed. You had a great score. Somehow everything came together to make that an almost perfect movie. I suppose if you want to find something wrong with it, you can. But it's remarkable how good all of their various pieces are. And I suppose if it was easy to make great movies, everybody would make, we'd have a lot more great movies than we have. Is it just, do you think, a matter of luck that everything comes together that way?
Well, a certain amount of luck, I guess. But you had some real talent there. You know, Roman Polanski is a fabulous director. Bob Town, great writer, and he had been a wonderful script. Bob Evans, a terrific producer who knew how to keep his hands on the helm. But we had a lot of conflict, too, between Bob Town and Polanski over the script. There were constant battles about various scenes. And I don't want to say who won out. It was a matter that eventually where they would compromise or agree on something. But it was a tussle, and even then, even when the film was finished, I recall when we had our first real screening of the finished film, not the rough cut, but some of us thought, "Oh my goodness, this is so long! It was so slow," and that became really ultimately the thing that people loved about the pace of the film was good. For it and for that story. Now you say the music. Yeah, the music was wonderful, but that was the second score. It was a score that was done and not used. They decided that it wasn't good enough or didn't work, and so it was rescored.
So there were places where things maybe could have gone wrong, it probably wouldn't have been a bad movie, but maybe it wouldn't be as good a movie, or so many of us wouldn't have thought it was such as good a movie as it was.
Right, I think that's true. I think if some of us who thought it was too slow were able to take 10 or 15 minutes out of it, it would have been a big mistake.
Yeah, and probably you couldn't make that movie now.
Well. Probably.
Let's talk with somebody else, someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Let's go back to your campus days. I recall that you were co-chairman of the senior ball, and I wondered if you remember what band played at the senior ball.
Is this Earl?
Yes.
How are you?
The ringer.
Stan Kenton.
Stan Kenton.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there.
That's right. You missed it.
That's right.
Okay. Thank
good,
you.
Good to hear from you, Earl.
Thanks for the So you planned this event, but you didn't go?
No, I was drafted. I was gone.
Oh, yeah. I see. Okay.
At that time. I left in March.
Okay. Stan Kenton, pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good. Pretty big name. Other questions here are welcome if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, CEO Doc Erickson, a man who's had a long career in Hollywood working as a producer and production manager on a lot of movies. And it just the list of movies is pretty mind-boggling when you list them all.
David, you did mention that I had over 30 years experience. I want
yes,
to correct that, if I may, now
yes,
that
sir.
I'm old and retired. Yes. It was about 50 years.
Oh, well, all right. Blame the Internet Movie Database for over 50 years for being a little bit behind.
No, they've taken that out of the Directors Guild directory, I think, which the 30 years didn't sound too awful. You know.
Well, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I was just thinking about the fact that I would be talking with you, and this morning on Morning Edition, they had a feature about some of the big summer movies that will be opening soon and talked about the fact that the new Spider-Man 3, now is said to be the most expensive movie ever made. I think they said $270 million.
Yeah, I read
dollars.
That somewhere, yeah.
So that's a lot of money. And but I was just thinking about one of the movies that you were involved with, Cleopatra, the one with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard
right.
Burton. I seem to recall that at the time that movie was made, it was said to be the most expensive movie that
I think it was up to that time, yes. We spent well over $30 million on that picture. But if inflation enters the picture, too, and all pictures cost a lot more today than they did then. So it's hard to compare. I don't know if you had to make that picture today exactly as we made it, what it would cost. On the other hand, you wouldn't make it exactly the way we did because of the advances in technology. There'd be different ways of accomplishing the same thing, you know.
So did $30 million dollars seem an astronomical figure?
It did. Actually, truthfully, I was in Germany on John Huston's picture, Freud, when I was called to see if I was available to come to Rome because Johnny Johnston, Forrest Johnston, had become ill and had to return. He was the production manager, associate producer to Joe Mankiewicz. And I was able to get away. It hadn't quite finished Freud, but they said it was okay. I could go in January of 62, excuse me. And I recall we had heard that the pictures was costing around $12 million or so, which we thought was, you know, really high.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't used to those kind of numbers. So I was, the first day I was there, I was walking back to the hotel. We'd been driven over to the Grand Hotel, and we were staying at the Excelsior. So Sid Rigel, who was there, one of the production reps from Fox, said, well, walk with me. So we're walking along, and I said, well, how's this, you know, $12 million is an awful lot of money you're spending. He said, $12 million? Are you kidding? How do you feel about 20? And I said, now don't believe this, I said. And but it went on from there, you know, kept increasing.
Do you just offhand remember how much Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton were paid to be in the movie?
I don't know exactly what Richard was paid. I think his deal might have been for something like $200,000, but he went way past his contract. When I arrived in January, he hadn't worked, and his contract had ended sometime in October, and he was still being paid.
Well, so they signed him up for a certain period of time,
yes.
And within that time, he had never stood in front of the camera?
That's right, yeah. So that ran up the cost. But Elizabeth, you know, the deal, it's well-documented, got $1 million.
Yeah.
It was the first $1 million payout for an actress. And that was, Walter Wanger made the phone call to their house and said, he got Eddie Fisher on the phone. Eddie answered. They were married at the time. Mm-hmm. And Eddie said, Elizabeth, it's Walter Wanger. She was in the bath. And so she said, who is it? It's Walter Wanger. What does he want? He said, what do you want, Walter? Walter said, I want her to play Cleopatra. He wants you to play Cleopatra. Tell him I'll do it for $1 million. You got it, he said. He hung up, went to Fox, and said, I've got Elizabeth Taylor for $1 million. And they went ahead.
So she was just trying to brush the guy off? Just,
yeah, not brush him off, but I'll do it.
$1 million bucks.
$1 million bucks, I'll do it.
And then he said,
I'll pay it.
That's just
it. And that's the way it went.
That must really have blown a lot of people's minds at the time, $1 million. Of course, now people are getting $9 million, $10 million. And at that time, it just must have just people must have been tearing their hair out thinking, what, $1 million? Yeah. I'm sure that there were people said nobody is worth, even Elizabeth Taylor is not worth $1 million.
No, it's huge.
How much did that movie make?
Well, it finally got into profit, but I don't know how much exactly. Yeah, okay. It's a beautiful picture. If you ever see it on television,
I suppose it's one of the last of the big time epic cast of thousands.
Yes.
Big sets kind of things. you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that now. Like if you were making Gladiator in those days, I guess you would have gone out and built a model of the Colosseum and filled it with thousands of people. You don't do that anymore.
Can I tell you a $1 million story?
Yeah, please.
Fall of the Roman Empire with Sophia Loren. And I had known Sophia and Carlo from the past, and I'd worked with her on a picture with Sidney Lumet, and that's how we all met. But we were shooting in Segovia on location, and Carlo would call Sophia every morning to say, how are you, how are things going, and so on and so forth. Early in the morning, while she was in makeup, he knew when he could reach her. And this one morning, I get her assistant called up to my room and said, Doc, Carlo wants to talk to you after he finishes talking to Sophia. I said, oh, good. I'm happy. I'll be right here waiting for his call. So he came on the line, and I said, hi, Carlo, how are you doing, Doc? He said, what do you think of the script? I said, I think it's terrific, Carlo. I said, don't you? He said, I didn't read the script. I said, you didn't read the script? They offer me $1 million. I don't have to read the script.
Well, let's talk with somebody else here in Gibson City, line number one right here.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, so I guess I was wondering what it was like working with Alfred Hitchcock. He's one of my favorites. And if you could talk a little bit about working on Rear Window. I believe that was one of the ones you worked on. And I'll hang up and listen. And thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Rear Window was the first film I did with Hitch. Actually, it was my first opportunity to work as a production manager on a feature film. I had worked as an assistant on a couple of films. But I was selected because Paramount was down to rock bottom with production managers, had nobody else to turn to. And so they took a chance, thought maybe I had enough experience and I could handle it. After all, the picture was all done on one stage, stage 18, and in the studio, so they figured everything would be all right. Hitch was a dream to work with because he just, he was pleasant. I never saw him angry. He might pout a little bit if he was unhappy about something, but he was very even-tempered. He had a great sense of humor. He loved to kid around, and a practical joke amused him, and he just was a pleasure to have come on the set. Very organized, punctual, knew what he wanted, got what he wanted, and did his work. He was just enjoyable.
Hmm. This movie, if in case people have not seen it, this is the story of a man. Jimmy Stewart plays this man who's a photographer who has a broken leg, so he's laid up. He's in his apartment. He can't go out. And he amuses himself by looking out his window to the apartment building that's across the way and looking, essentially looking in people's windows and watching what is going on, and he sees, or he thinks he sees, a murder. So that's what sort of sets the story in motion. Raymond Burr is the the alleged murderer, and Grace Kelly is in this movie. Got to be one of the most beautiful women ever to grace the screen. And sort of the story is about how he pursues this, even though he can't leave the apartment, and he tries to convince the authorities that, in fact, something did happen, and they, of course, think, throw a lot in the movie, they think, well, he's not quite, he hasn't quite got it right. So to make this movie, though, they actually built what you see as you look out, what you see, what he sees as he looks out the window, this apartment building across the way. In the studio, they actually built this, the facade of this apartment building.
Every bit of it. We took a stage 18, had a basement, which is unusual, but we had props stored there and things like that. So we cleaned all of that out and went down to the ground floor with the set. So that became the yard, the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And then his set was on the stage level. And then the background, of course, was a high enough stage that you could go up with the buildings beyond. They were cheated a little bit because of the height, but not much. I mean, you're not aware of it. It works out very nicely. We had a little alleyway, and then we used small cars passing there once in a while, but it really was not that effective, so we didn't use too much of that.
Mm.
But it was a remarkable set. Mac Johnson, the art director, that built it. And it was, you know, Hitch's notion that that's what he wanted to do, and we made it work. It would have been easier today with cameras and lenses and lights that we have. It was tough because of the trying to hold focus across that area.
It makes me think about the way that movies were made at that time, particularly big movies where we wanted to have big visual impact, and that, for example, one of the movies I know you were involved in was 55 Days at Peking, which I think must have been one of the last big, epic kind of things, cast of thousands sort of things, where when you made that movie, you actually went out to Spain and built a replica of a piece of the city of Peking of the time, a full-scale set.
True.
Which then later in the movie, I think large parts of it you burned.
Burned,
down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now I don't think they would do that now.
Possibly not. We'd find a way to use tricks.
I happen to like that movie. I don't know if anybody thinks that that's a wonderful movie, but I kind of think it was entertaining. Maybe because when I first saw it, I was a teenage boy. Any stories that come out of that movie? Certainly, with some big stars on the movie.
Yes, there were several things that happened. Nicholas Ray was supposed to direct it, and I joined the company, the Bronston Company, in the late summer of 1962, early fall. And met with Nick, but he was at home in bed because he was ill, and not going to come back to direct the film. And Andrew Martin, eventually became the director. We did talk to some other people, but Andrew did it. And had some good, some big stars and so on. And Chuck Heston, of course, mm-hmm. was a star. And Chuck, it was interesting the work we did with Chuck. Because he was just chomping at the bit to get out of there to report to George Stevens for the part of John the Baptist in The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Uh-huh.
So we had two units. We had a day and unit, a night unit where he was involved, and he was shooting both ends in order to get out of there to meet the schedule. So,
uh-huh.
Which... it's not, you don't find people doing that too often.
Probably, Let's talk with somebody in Belgium, nearby community here, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. To return to Mr. Hitchcock for just a moment, I was given the impression that, like Clint Eastwood, he has lots of shots of San Francisco in his films. Am I right about that?
I think only in Vertigo.
Oh. Well, I thought he was in other films. So I knew the Birds was filmed just north
well,
of there.
Well, Birds, yes, but it wasn't San Francisco.
It wasn't San Francisco.
No. And he did do, you know, Strangers on a Train was Santa Rosa, I believe.
So he did a lot of them in the California area.
Oh, yes, yes.
All of them have things like that, yes.
Yes, but he also, just to extend talking about Hitch for a moment, Hitch loved to go abroad and do filming. And his idea was that if he could take the principals to the location and shoot them there, take Jimmy and Grace or Carrie and Grace, whoever, and establish the fact that they were actually in Marrakesh or in the south of France or in London, do what you had to do there, live in a nice hotel, eat well, Hitch loved to dine, and then go back to the studio where he could stay at home and be very comfortable and shoot the rest of the picture and use rear projection or sets or whatever to complete it.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks. We had somebody actually also asking as an off-the-air question about Hitchcock, noting the fact that, as I think probably people will know, that one of the things that he liked to do was put himself in just a tiny little appearance. Sometimes you have to look very closely. It might be a crowded street scene when your main character is walking along, and just then out of the corner of your eye, you'll catch him. He'll walk by. He'll go get on a bus. So he'd like to do little things like that.
Yes. You know, he did, I think in Rear Window, he was in Ross Bagdasarian's studio, the musician's studio. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether he was working on a clock there, repairing a clock. Wasn't tuning the piano, I don't think, but working on the clock. And he was on the bus in the background in to catch a man who knew too much. Mm-hmm. Other places, I can't
I think
tell you exactly.
In North by Northwest, isn't there just a street scene where Cary Grant is walking down the street or something?
Yeah.
And Hitchcock just walks through the frame at some point. You know, nothing really obvious, but if you knew who he was
right,
and what he looked
right.
like, you'd know that was him.
He did a walkthrough, I think, on Craftsbury Common in Trouble with Harry, just a passerby.
Yeah. Why did he like to do that?
He did it. His excuse for doing it, but he was, of course, he wanted to see himself on screen. That's the main reason. His excuse was that when in the early days he was making very low budget pictures, and he needed all the people he could on screen, and so they would fill in. But I think that's. That's not the truth.
Way of getting an extra without having to pay
them. Right, right.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, CEO Doc Erickson. He has been a producer and production manager on a lot of big Hollywood movies. He's been involved in the business for over 50 years. He began his career at Paramount, working as production manager on 5 Hitchcock films, among them Rear Window. He worked with John Huston on a number of movies, including The Misfits, with Joseph Mankiewicz on the film There Was a Crooked Man, with Robert Evans on Chinatown, and then a number of other movies, Lonely Guy, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Nicholas and Alexandra, Blade Runner, 55 Days at Peking, Urban Cowboy, Popeye. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana, where he went to school. He's here visiting for the film festival, the Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival, the 9th annual festival. It's now going on. The movies are being shown at the Virginia Theater. Tomorrow morning, by the way, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk with another person who's here for the festival, and that's Paul Cox. He's an Australian filmmaker, and one of his movies is being shown, and I believe that's on Saturday. His film, Man of Flowers, is showing Saturday afternoon at 2:30 at the Virginia. Questions certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. No, we were talking. I talked a little bit earlier about mentioned that the new Spider-Man movie is coming out, and it cost a lot of money, and a lot of that money is special effects money. I'm sure nowadays, you know, Tobey Maguire, I'm sure he got a really nice paycheck for being in the movie.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is goes on special effect.
Absolutely.
And we're talking about how nowadays you can achieve that way using computers, basically, achieve great visual impact so that you don't really have to go out to Spain and build a two-scale replica of the city of Peking, or you don't have to go build the Roman Colosseum. You can essentially do that. You actually have to build, I'm sure, some sets. You have to have a physical place to put your actors. But a lot of that stuff, you can achieve a great effect by doing it with the computer. Do you think, though, that that really makes a big, in terms of the way the movie works, the way it feels, the way people respond to it, doing it that way, the old way where you actually went out and built big sets and you put your actors in it, now when they do it so much with effects and actors sometimes are in fact just acting in front of screens and then they fill in the background later?
Yes, I don't know exactly. It depends on the story and the performers, whether you can get the feeling that you want. I have not seen 300, which I understand was done with green screen throughout.
Yeah.
And it's a highly successful movie. So it works. But in the old way, it was cumbersome and expensive and time-consuming. And sometimes, well, I don't know, you had to maybe, for budget purposes, cheat a bit if you were on a spectacle. But you can do anything now. And it looks real. I mean, you can't tell that it was done with computer activity. And it's great, I think. And I think that we talked a bit, some of us, on making of Wind Talkers, and I'm not sure that we were actually right, but we thought that perhaps we were seeing the end of a picture that was made with huge explosions and the use of powder and gasoline and everything for fire effects was going to become a thing of the past because you could do it with the computer. And I don't know whether that's really taking place or not, since I'm not in the business at the minute.
Well, I think about, you were talking about Hitchcock and the way that he worked. That is, he would like to give the feeling of some feeling of authenticity to the movie. He would do some location shooting so that then you would actually buy into the idea that the actors were there. But that after he'd felt he'd done enough of that, then he would go home.
That's right.
They would do the rest on the soundstage. And for example, I'm thinking about a movie like To Catch a Thief, where there are shots of Cary Grant and Grace Kelly driving a car in Monaco, driving along.
Yes.
Where
yeah.
when you look at that now, to our eye, it is very clear that there's a back projection, that you know they're sitting in a studio somewhere, they're sitting in a car, and what they're doing is projecting in back, essentially. They're projecting a movie of the background. And to us now, we look at that and we think, that looks terrible. That looks like a back. My question is, when people saw, when that movie was first out, did people buy it or did they look at it and think, nah, come on. They're not really driving down the road. They're in Monaco.
No, I think that a little bit of both, because I think that they accept it. They would say, oh, well, I guess that was a background. But they're not unhappy about it because they're moving the story along, and it's fine. And then you're outside the car, and you see a lot of the south of France. So you're not being cheated out of the actual location. But I agree with you. When you look at it now, you are jarred by it because also we've become more sophisticated and more picky about what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah.
We're spoiled because it's gotten so it's improved so much, the background shots. Or the other thing is that now, and for quite a long time, you are actually mounting a camera inside the car and shooting because the camera is small enough and sound is good enough that you could shoot them for real.
You know? You could actually do it. Well,
sure.
Probably the car. They probably wouldn't really be driving. Maybe you'd be
somebody
you'd
else would drive, towing the car.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But they would be sitting
would
in
be
the car.
Sitting in the car.
And the car would be moving.
Moving.
And you'd see the actual
right.
background as the scenery as it actually passed
by. And it'd be perfectly
by.
All right. But yeah. then it was too difficult to do those things.
Someone called in, again, I guess this is a Hitchcock fan, who said that one of his favorite movies is The Trouble with Harry. And I know that was one that you were involved with. Just wanted to know if you know, could talk about the movie.
Interesting. Yeah, it is. It's a cute little picture. That story was set in rural England. I think so, yeah, in England. And Hitch said he didn't want to shoot an English picture, so he decided that he would transfer it to Vermont, and he could get away with a different setup of people. And we went forward with it. That was Shirley MacLaine's first film, John Forsythe's first film. Mm-hmm. Teddy Gwynn was somebody that Hitch had worked with many, many times, many years ago. And we had a lot of fun. It was a good time. We went there to shoot the fall foliage and so on, and we didn't get any because it was a late fall. It was raining and wet, and we did all of the interiors in a gymnasium in Vermont, and we did the exteriors on a stage 12 and 14 at Paramount with a big backing, mm-hmm. lots of leaves and logs and stuff like that. Got away with it.
We have 3-4 minutes if somebody wants to call. Oh, and we have a caller right here. We'll get him in, and it's in Savoy, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm not being able to find much about Mr. Erickson on through Google or Wikipedia. Is there any reference he can give us as to how to learn more about him through the Internet?
IMDb.com.
That's the Internet Movie Database. If you go there, there's a bio and there's a list of all the movies that he was involved with.
All right, thank you.
I Googled myself, though, and got them all. I'm surprised.
All right, well,
good luck.
Again, other questions, if somebody wants to call real quick, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-95. So of all that, you've worked with a number of really important, significant directors. Of all of those people, Hitchcock and John Huston and on, who of them would you, if you just wanted to go out for a drink or have dinner or just sit around, you know, just sit around and have an evening, who would be the person that you're, or would there be people that you would pick that if you were just wanted to spend some time hanging out with and have a good time that you would pick?
Oh, just for an evening of conversation and dinner and fine wine, I suppose it would have to be Hitch, you know. He excelled in that category. Mm-hmm. He was just great. But they're all interesting in their own way. John Huston was bigger than life, of course. And recent people like Harold Ramis, who did Groundhog Day. He's a wonderful fellow to be around.
Yeah.
Great sense of humor and really pleasant and interesting man.
I know that a lot of people like that movie, and that was a film that I hadn't. The movie came out, and I only just recently saw it for the first time.
Really?
I don't know how it is that you. Yes, I think it was just last year was the first time that I saw the movie, and there wasn't any particular reason I was avoiding it. I don't know why. I just had never seen it, and my wife rented it, brought it home, and we watched it. And that is a terrific movie. I don't know why it is that for some reason all those years I didn't see it, but it's a good story. Bill Murray turns in a really nice performance.
He does,
and so does anybody. So all the people in it are very good, and it's not like it's a big star vehicle. It's not, a lot of stuff doesn't blow up.
No,
it's somehow the story, and it's the, as you're watching Bill Murray's character try to figure out what is going on, what's happening, and what he's going to do to get out of the cycle is the thing that I think really holds you in the story.
Well, it's the story that holds it. And there isn't a week that goes by that you don't hear or read in op-ed or somebody's work, somebody's statement, some sermon, whatever. They make a reference, just like in Groundhog Day, they'll say. And we know what they mean.
Yes. Exactly. Was that a movie that was a hard sell for Harold Ramis when he was talking about making the movie?
No, it wasn't. I don't think we had any trouble. It was all set up at Columbia at that time, or Sony. We did have a little delay in getting the script finalized, but that was Harold and the writer and Bill contributing, of course. And so there was a slight hang-up, but once they got over that, which wasn't much of a delay. The studio was, well, they were behind it all the way, and we didn't have any trouble. money-wise, it was not a terribly expensive picture, but at that time. Mm-hmm. No, they were fine.
Of all the movies, I know this is really hard. People get asked a question like this. Out of all these various movies we've talked about and the ones that you've been involved in, are there one or two that you would say are your favorites?
Yes. It's the same group, probably. I mean, To Catch a Thief, because it was so much fun working on it. The Misfits, because of the people involved. Chinatown, certainly. And so on. So it's hard to narrow it down. You know, you can't say one.
Yeah.
But they were all fun. A lot of fun to work.
Yeah. It's really hard to think of people, though, who today, actors today, certainly there are some who have real screen presence. But some of the people who have been in some of those movies, like Cary Grant, to have that kind of screen presence, it's really very rare.
I agree. I mean, he is just, he stands out among all of them. If you look, you watch Turner Classic Movies and see movie after movie after movie that he's in, and he's never bad.
Yeah.
And he is just a brilliant performer.
It always looked so much at ease. And in a sense, even when the character was not at ease, when he was really uncomfortable,
right,
when he was trying to figure out, what am I doing here? What's going on here? Somehow he just had a certain ease.
Yeah.
He seemed to move through life so with such grace, It was really amazing.
Yeah, of course, and he's best where there is some comic strain to the film,
Well,
fabulous.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say. I'm sure we could keep going here. But for the moment, we'll have to conclude with our thanks to CEO Doc Erickson. He's here visiting Champaign-Urbana, where he went to school back in the 1940s, visiting for the festival, the Overlooked Film Festival. And if you're interested in finding out more background of him, do indeed go to the Internet Movie Database and put his name on there, and you can see a list of all of the movies that he's worked on. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I've enjoyed it.